Heads up, horror fans. Say no to drugs and stay out of the basement. You're listening.
We interrupt our program to bring you
Final
Girl
Friday.
Welcome to Final Girl Friday. My name is Molly, and I like scary movies. Tonight, for the first time since I started this podcast, I'll be talking about the film that inspired that introduction. A dear friend and fellow member of the Bring Kirby Back Right Now Please movement, Eli, will be joining me, and we'll be talking about Screams 1 through 4, comparing our ranked lists of the films, and awarding some well-deserved superlatives to some of our favorite characters. Before we can dive into it, though, I do have a few points of interest I'd like to touch down on in horror news.
In the news tonight, an escaped convict from the asylum has escaped, and he's mental, and he's on the loose and stuff.
Oh my god, that sounds dangerous.
First things first, of course, the thing everybody is talking about, we now have confirmation that David Arquette will be reprising his role as Dewey Riley for Scream 5. The Hollywood Reporter quoted Arquette last week as saying, "I am thrilled to be playing Dewey again and to reunite with my Scream family. Scream has been such a big part of my life, and for both the fans and myself, I look forward to honoring Wes Craven's legacy." I'm actually starting to get pretty excited about Scream 5. I didn't think I would feel that way, but it's happening. Between Arquette coming back and the seemingly hardcore Craven respect from the crew, if they can bring Nev Campbell on and figure out a way to believably work Kirby back into the story, this might turn out to be a great movie. It's also been a lot of fun listening to all the fan theories and speculation about what to expect from Dewey now that we know he's coming back. I think my personal favorite thus far comes from YouTuber Drumdums, who says he hopes Dewey will be killed in the new film's opening scenes. As much as I love Dewey, and I do, I actually think killing him off at the start would be an incredible, albeit heartbreaking way to invoke the spirit of the first film. Scream 5 will be directed by Matthew Bettinelli-Olpin and Tyler Gillette, the duo behind Ready or Not, with Kevin Williamson on board as an executive producer. That's mostly all we know for sure about the project thus far. They're supposed to start shooting in the fall. Of course, it's hard to say for certain if that will happen with so many projects being pushed back due to the pandemic. For a little recommended reading, we have the latest installment in the ongoing editorial series Stay Home, Watch Horror at Bloody Disgusting, where Megan Navarro gives us 5 dark fairy tales to stream this week. And Anthony Caro of HorrorNews.net delivered a truly moving article earlier this month entitled A Hard Rain is Going to Fall on Friday the 13th, where he explores the artistic merits of the first Friday film. To give you just a taste of where Caro is coming from with this exploration, here's a little excerpt. "Pamela's reign of terror is not unlike the rain that falls in the woods. Destructive, yes, but not entirely unnatural. Pamela Voorhees is a rainfall that turns into a hurricane of mindless devastation." I love that article so much. Just read it, please, if you have not yet. I also discovered a new podcast recently. It's called Modern Horror Show, and I am a teensy bit obsessed with it. I cannot recommend this podcast enough. Its host, The Wicker Matt, he is a wonderful storyteller. I could listen to this guy talk about movies all day long.
Good evening, and welcome to Modern Horror Show, a podcast dedicated to finding, talking about, and recommending the finer horror movies, specifically of the 21st century.
My personal favorite reviews that he's done so far are of Ari Aster's Hereditary and Midsommar, as well as Hell House LLC Part 3 and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Modern Horror Show is also an anchor podcast, so you can find it pretty much in all of the places that you can find my podcast, as far as I know. My only complaint about Modern Horror Show is that there isn't enough of it. Dear Matt, please make more episodes. Sincerely, Molly. If you're new to Final Girl Friday and you don't hate it, stay tuned until the end of this episode for information regarding this project elsewhere, as well as additional details on how to enter the giveaway for May's B-Movie of the Month. Next week, hopefully on the 5th of June, that's what I'm shooting for, I will be giving away a small grab bag of Sleepaway Camp swag at the end of my long look at the movie. Yes, I will technically be doing my deep dive into Sleepaway Camp the first week of June, and it was the B-Movie of the Month for May, but I am the world's slowest editor, and I am really terrible at time management, so I fell really behind in my schedule this month. Right now, I want to focus on the fact that I will be announcing the winner of the Sleepaway Camp giveaway, hopefully on Friday, June 5th. If you'd like to know what items will be included in the swag bag, or if you'd like to know how to enter to win it, then yeah, stay tuned until the end of this episode. I'm going to go into all of that before I wrap up. Lastly, I just want to thank everyone, both on the Discord and on Slasher, for all of your kind birthday wishes a couple of weeks ago, and for the overwhelmingly positive responses to my happening review. review. I was honestly a little worried about it, as it was the first time I had ever talked at length and candidly about a filmmaker I don't like very much, and I was afraid I was going to come across as a complete ass. And I mean, it's definitely possible that I did, but you were all so nice and supportive about it, and the episode hit a new record for me in terms of plays, so just thank you. You guys made my birthday such a fun day. And now, to the Scream discussion. This conversation was originally 6 hours long, carried on over a period of 2 days, so I had to cut a lot out of it. We knew we weren't going to be able to talk briefly about all four Scream films we had prepared for this, so a lot of what didn't make it into the discussion you'll hear today, I'm going to be cutting together and releasing on Patreon over the course of the next couple of weeks. So if you're a patron, keep an eye out for that. And as usual, if you haven't seen all the films in the Scream series, proceed with caution, because we will most certainly be spoiling all of them for you. I am so happy to have with me tonight my friend and coworker, Eli. Hi, Eli.
Hi, Molly. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm really excited to have you here. We have been talking about doing this episode since I started this podcast last summer, So glad we're finally getting around to it. So Eli and I have been working together for a little under 2 years, and we actually initially bonded at work not long after I started talking about doing this podcast. It was just something I was kind of kicking around. And from there, our friendship sort of grew and has been very heavily rooted in a mutual love of horror films. But Eli sort of regards themselves as a fledgling horror fan. Is that correct?
It is. I was not a huge fan of the genre growing up. It scared the crap out of me as a child, and I did not really have an appreciation for being scared. So it wasn't until very recently that I decided to give it another shot and go back and watch some scary movies.
Well, let's just jump into it. What we've done for tonight, we've each ranked the Scream films. We didn't meet, like I didn't get with you beforehand and see like what criteria you were using for your rankings or anything. I have not seen your ranked list. I'm excited to see how our lists differ from one another. But before we get into the great rank debate, when did you first see Scream?
I was pretty young, and I will confess that I mixed it up with Scary Movie for the longest time because I saw bits and pieces of both of them as a child. And in my memory, a lot of things got mixed up. So I didn't actually sit down and watch Scream with intent until a couple of years ago. And at that point, I couldn't remember if Dewey was the killer in the first movie, because in Scary Movie, spoof Dewey is.
Right, right.
And then at the end of the movie, when it was Billy and Stu, I was like, wait, what's going on? So this Scream obsession is pretty recent, actually.
That's so funny because and I've said this to you before, but I always forget how much younger you are than me. There were really good things about being around at the beginning, at the dawn of the post-Scream era. I had never seen anything like Scream. Nothing like that had ever existed in my life, unless you would count like Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which I loved then and I love now. I was a horror fan, but I was more of like the Alex Proyas kind of heady, fantastical horror at that time, at that age. Scream was very new, and it opened a lot of doors. It rewrote a lot of the rules of the slasher subgenre, and it was great to be there and to be a part of that. But I also think it's really great that somebody 13 years younger could discover it and fall in love with it. I love that Scream has proven so far to be timeless, especially when you consider how meta the films are.
Honestly, that is one of the biggest draws for me to the first one especially, is because it's so meta. But they don't do it in a super like ham-fisted kind of way, which I think that they do in the third one. The first one was nice and subtle, but also still a little scary.
Well, so how would you rank these films? You know, from 1 to 4, 1 being the best and 4 being the worst.
Even though I'm not super happy with myself about it, I think my ranking would have to go 1, 2, 4, and 3.
And you're not happy about that because you didn't want Scream 4 to be third?
Yes, I did not want to like it more than one of the original three. Just God, Scream 3 just does not do it for me the way the other ones do.
Well, no, I completely understand that. I feel like I'm setting myself up to lose a lot of credibility. My ranking would be 1, 3, 4. and two.
Oh, you're killing me.
I know. My criteria has nothing to do with the quality of the film as a horror film. It has everything to do with my enjoyment. The rankings were all over the place depending on the criteria. And so I was like, you know, fuck it. I'm just going to rank them based on how much of a kick I get out of them.
That's fair. See, my enjoyment of the films kind of matches how I think of them as films. Mm-hmm. So mine was pretty, whatever the best film is also the one that I happen to enjoy the most. I will admit, though, if we are talking about enjoyment, the opening of Scream 2 just kills me every time. I don't like it.
Oh, yeah. It's so, I hate it. I hate the opening.
It's so weird and jarring because it's such a different tone than the rest of the film.
I hated Phil's death. What the fuck was that? The fucking knife through the bathroom wall.
That was so weird. I legitimately confused it with that same scene in Scary Movie.
I don't blame you.
Which is why I confuse Scary Movie and the Scream movie so much. That tells you how hokey and weird it was, because when they put it into a parody film, they didn't even change much.
No, they really didn't. They just basically reshot that scene and they turned it into a penis instead of a knife. Like,
yeah. And then that whole thing with her being loud and obnoxious in the theater and like all of it, like they really did not have to change much.
Yeah. God. All right. Well, let's talk about our first rank, our number one, which is the same, which is the first Scream, obviously.
So I have an anxiety disorder, and that manifested when I was young in an absolute panic attack-inducing hatred of horror movies. My mother was a great fan of Stephen King, still is, and I watched It when I was 3, the Tim Curry version, and...
Oh, you poor thing.
Yeah, and then Rose Red, that miniseries he did, I watched that when that came out in the early 2000s when I was like 5 or 6, so I hated scary movies. And so a few years ago, when I watched Scream, part of the reason I liked it was that it is a horror movie, but it wasn't so scary that I couldn't watch it.
Right.
Like you say in your notes, you call it Horror 101, and that's exactly what it is. And it's a really solid Horror 101 movie. So if I feel like watching a scary movie and I don't feel like I have the emotional energy to watch something new, especially something that's purported to be really scary, I can just go watch Scream.
When I remarked that it's Horror 101, that was sort of in response to this interview that I read with Matthew Lillard, where he talked quite a bit about how he just didn't understand why Scream was so popular. He wasn't ragging on the film or anything, but he just couldn't really wrap his brain around why, of all of the things that he's done in his career, why Stew seems to be the thing for which he is still the most celebrated. And the guy who was interviewing him talked about Scream being a gateway film. And I think that it's like that for a lot of people. It was certainly like that for me. I don't know that I would have become such a slasher fan if it hadn't been for that film that kind of taught me the many different ways in which a less fantastical horror film could charm me, and the fun to be had in the genre and things like that. And it being so self-referential as well. I mean, it kind of, it's like a crash course education in horror films. And I wonder too, sometimes, you know, whether or not the film would have acted as such an adequate gateway for people just getting into the genre if the MPAA had gotten off of Wes Craven's ass about all of the blood and violence. There are so many stories surrounding most of these movies having to just be just chopped to bits because of the MPAA. And that annoys me. But at the same time, I wonder if in the case of the first film, that didn't actually create something quite special.
Honestly, I quite enjoy the gore level that the first one is at. In the first film, I think Casey Becker might have been like the goriest death, her and her boyfriend.
Oh, I think, yeah, with what we got, Casey's is the most brutal death, which is just so fascinating to me because it wasn't just the most brutal death. It's certainly one of the more memorable, and it set this like unprecedented tone for the film that they killed off like the biggest name in the movie, or one of the biggest names in the movie.
We don't have any reason on the opening of the film not to expect Drew Barrymore to be the main character.
Oh, it's so true. I thought she was.
Yeah, and so when she's getting terrorized, you kind of, in the back of your head, you're like, yeah, this is happening, and her boyfriend just died horribly in front of her, but like, she's the final girl, and then she dies.
Yeah.
Horribly. Oh, that moment where her parents are walking up the porch to the door, and it shows her behind them come around the side of the house, but she's already been stabbed, and she can't make noise, and so she tries to scream out to them.
Yeah, such a huge part of the film were those surprises. Killing Casey off in the beginning, having two killers, and the constant misdirection, which was so effective.
Yeah. the way that they do Casey's death is part of the reason that watching it the first time, I kept questioning myself because I was like, it's got to be Billy. He's such a fucking creeper. But then I was like, but maybe it's not because, you know, I thought they were going to do this in the opening scene and then they did something else. They put an equal amount of effort into making you think he is the killer as they do in making you think he's not the killer.
Exactly.
So by the end of the movie, you're like, I don't even know what's going on anymore. I've also been known to watch a true crime documentary or 10. Oftentimes, if they're talking about a pair of killers, they always talk about like a dominant personality and a submissive one. And you can really see that play out with Billy and Stu. Because Billy has like an agenda and he knows what he wants to do. He has a plan and motive. And Stu's his best friend. And there's even that scene in the video store where Randy calls him a mindless lapdog or something.
Yeah.
Which is very true because Stu tends to do what Billy does.
It's kind of cool because Kevin Williamson, he had a very difficult time trying to decide between the killers having motive and the killers not having motive. And there were debates happening on set just throughout the production about the validity and the scare factor of motive versus no motive, which just, I think, makes the conversation in the kitchen, you know, that Billy is having with Sydney about motive just all the more fascinating. So I thought it was really cool that Williamson decided to just do both. Like, I can't choose, so I'm going to create two killers and one is going to have a clear motive and the other is going to have no motive. I thought that made both Billy and Stu just equally interesting in very different ways. So we've talked about, you know, what is probably our, at least the most brutal, if not our favorite kill in the movie, which is Casey Becker in the beginning. But let's talk about Tatum's death in the garage.
That garage door. I have a lot of feelings about
I know you
garage
do.
Door. Tatum is such a badass character and I love her so much. And I'm really mad that that's how she dies because it's such a stupid way to die. If it had been anybody else, I don't know that I would have minded as much. But because it's Tatum, I'm just so mad about it.
Well, and what's so funny is that, like, so Rose McGowan she kept falling out of the garage door, you know, because she was so tiny and the garage door was the little doggy door thing was so big that
exactly
like, not only could the garage door probably never have operated that way with a person, you know, weighing it down like that, she wouldn't even have been stuck. And like,
you could see her almost falling out. I was like, no, just you've got your armpit over the edge, just pull your arm back and get out.
The whole scene, it was fun, but it's definitely the least believable kill of the movie. And it feels very much like they just wanted some really fun garage action. Part of the charm of the first Scream, it's I think part of what makes it so powerful in terms of slasher films is because of how heavily rooted it is in reality. So I think that's also why Tatum's death stands out, because it's just the least realistic.
And also because Tatum was so great. She was such a bitch, but loved her.
See, I didn't really see her as a bitch. She was full of sass. She spoke her mind, you know, and she was such a good friend to Sydney. I don't know. There was that awkward conversation between them where she was kind of telling Sydney how it was, you know, as far as like believing the rumors about Sid's mom. But mm-hmm. I mean, again, that's Tatum. She was a good friend. She was an honest friend.
She did the tough love with the harsh truth, but not in an asshole way. The idea that Cotton Weary had been arrested and sentenced to death for Maureen's death, I think Tatum understood the gravity of that. She wasn't going to back down and be like, no, your mom would never do that. I think she didn't want Sydney to have to deal with that if it came out later that she had been wrong. So Tatum was like, this is something that you need to think about.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, Sydney coming to terms with the reality of her mother, you know, and her mother's life is such a huge part of her journey as a character throughout the entire, you know, well, the first three films anyway. And so I like that conversation between them. It's kind of one of the first moments where Sydney is kind of confronted, however subtly, with the reality of her mom, with who her mom was. She's on a journey and Tatum was there at the very beginning of that, kind of helping her along.
I love the subplot of Sydney's journey with coming to terms with her mother and who she was and how that affects how Sydney views herself.
Yeah, same. All of the characters have
their own stories that feel very fleshed out and multidimensional. Nobody feels devoid of development in the first Scream.
That is a part of the reason that I love it so much. The more fleshed out and realistic and personable a character is, the more I have the ability to bond with them and connect with them and care about them, which is the reason that Scream 3 is ranked least on my list.
Yeah.
What makes Scream good is the characters, and because they're so fleshed out and because they're so realistic. And so when you get to the third movie and hardly any of them are like that, it's very jarring and it's really hard to connect with them and care that they're dying.
I completely agree, 100%. Which is why if I were ranking the films based solely on their quality as, you know, genre films, 3 would absolutely be last. It feels very empty.
It does.
I think the best example of the first Scream, how the first Scream excelled at character development, is that my favorite character in the first Scream film is Kenny, the fucking camera guy. Even he was so lovable. I kind of believe he's like the unsung hero of the first film. He uses like his last few moments on this mortal plane to save Sydney's life, not even knowing her, you know, and he's always kind of trying to keep Gail grounded in his own way. He's obviously a bit more of a pushover than like Joel, but he tries. He has hope and faith in Gail being a good person underneath it all. And also his death saves Gail's life. Him being up on the roof of the car and falling down onto the windshield is what causes Gail to crash. And her being unconscious in the van is what led Stu to believe she was dead. She wouldn't have been able to come back and save Sydney's life again if it weren't for Kenny. Fucking Kenny, man.
Ollie, you have a type when it comes to unappreciated side characters in movies.
I do.
Because Kenny is the slick of Scream.
Oh my God, you're
slightly
right.
Bigger guy who's a little bit of a nerd and he drives this creepy van.
Oh my God. I do. I love my nerdy little dudes in creepy vans that turn out to be like weirdly awesome people. I really do.
Yeah, I liked Kenny a lot. Yeah. His death was unfortunate.
Oh God. I really liked Kenny's death too. I would say Casey's death is my favorite, but I think Kenny's death is probably my second favorite simply because of the tension and the delivery. It was a very intense moment, a very cinematic death.
Kenny's death reminds me quite a lot of Wendy's death in Prom Night, because they both exit, you know, they both open a door and like exit something very suddenly and just walk right into the killer.
That's another thing that I love about all of the Scream films, but particularly the first, because I feel like it did it the most artfully, but just so many moments that drew direct inspiration from classic horror films like, you know, Prom Night, Halloween, Carrie, just so much. They did something that no one had ever really done. And they did it so well. And I think really reminded everyone, you know, before Scream came out, the horror genre itself was suffering. A lot of horror films were direct video. Most of them, you know, no matter what they were pretty poorly received by critics. And they brought it right the fuck back.
I will definitely say, as someone who was raised in a post-Scream world, when I go back and watch all of those old horror movies now, they definitely have a very different feel.
Oh, for sure.
And I can't quite articulate what it is.
There was a great article from Borrowing Tape by Taylor Ryan. I think he put it into much better words than I could. It is a masterfully crafted piece of metafiction that calls attention to the cliches and tropes of your typical slasher film and then subverts them. It is a very subversive film. And speaking of that sort of like metafiction element, let's talk about Randy.
I adore him. One of the things that I enjoy about Randy specifically is that he's the one character that almost knows that he's in a horror movie. And I thought it was very interesting that in the second Scream, Sydney is playing Cassandra in her university production, because Randy is really like the Cassandra of Scream 1. He's like, it's obviously Billy. And, you know, even in the beginning, when we see them all sitting at the fountain and we meet Randy as a character, he, like, kind of insinuates that Stu might be a suspect as well. Randy is just spot on the whole time, and no one listens to him.
I'm not really familiar with that play or the character of Cassandra.
Okay, so a quick rundown on Cassandra.
Yes, please.
He was pursued by the god Apollo, who, you know, is connected with the oracle at Delphi. And so when it comes to like prophetic things, Apollo was like the god that you go to. And she turned him down. And he cursed her to accurately predict the future, but no one would ever believe her. She foresaw the tragedy at Troy And she tried to tell people about it and she tried to warn them. But because of the way she'd been cursed, no one listened to her. So that's why I really like that they incorporated that into the Scream movies, because that's Randy all the way.
Jamie Kennedy really went at that role in full force. He had energy that sort of rivaled the energy of the character of Stu, which I think worked really well, especially at that scene that you were talking about where they're on the porch begging Sydney to let them in. You kind of realize in that moment just how similar Stu and Randy really are. And I think that that lent very well to, first of all, creating a red herring in Randy, but also just kind of making Randy that sort of unappreciated prophet. It kind of discredited him a little bit. Before we move on from the first Scream, we've talked about the metafiction and the great kills and the excellent character development. And all of that comes together to create what, for me, I've always considered to be a near flawless horror film. But I think one of the other things that contributes greatly to that is the score. Composed by Marco Beltrami, who was practically unknown at the time, but then went on to score all of the Scream films, as well as Halloween H2O and The Faculty. He approached the film not as a horror movie, but as a Morricone-style Western. And I think that that was such a fucking awesome choice.
Yes, that was honestly one of the first things that I noticed when I sat down to watch it again with the intention of dissecting it and taking notes, was that the music is so good.
The second on your ranked list is Scream 2, correct?
Yes, it is.
All right. So let's talk about Scream 2.
The great ranking debate has begun.
Yes. I don't hate Scream 2. I don't. I'm just not as much a fan of it as I am of the other ones. But I definitely understand why everybody else but me loves it. Like, I get it.
Part of the reason that I love Scream 2 is because of the evolution we get to see with Sydney's character. It very clearly and very quickly establishes her as much more confident, much more of a badass. She's been through this before, and she has a clear idea of how she wants to handle it this time.
Yeah.
And I really, really like her in Scream 2.
I agree with that. I do really like Sydney in the second film, for sure.
I also really liked Derek, and I felt so bad for that poor guy.
Yeah, poor Derek.
Because he tried so hard. I get the sense from your notes, because you do mention that his actor specifically had to do the Top Gun scene,
which is my least favorite scene in the film.
Yeah, I got that sense that you didn't like it very much. But honestly, I love that scene. It doesn't really fit with the movie, but it's so cute, and it's this like bright spot in this otherwise just shit-filled time of Sid's life. Because God knows nothing else in her life gets to be like normal or easy.
I can see where you're coming from on that, for sure. First of all, it does establish Derek as a pretty sweet guy who definitely loves Sydney, that he's willing to kind of debase himself in front of the entire school, and that he's also willing to break the rule of giving her his letters. This is a guy that really cares about Sid, and it is effective in creating in Derek a bit of suspicion for the audience, I think. Is he trying too hard to prove that he loves Sydney here?
That's fair. They do cut certain scenes and frame them in certain ways as to inspire suspicion. Like the close-up when he and Sydney are leaving the porch after Cece's death.
Yeah, that was, I think that was one of the scenes where they really pushed him hard as the killer.
They spend the whole scene establishing how suspicious his injury is on his arm. What I really enjoyed was how they worked really hard with Derek to make him as opposite of Billy as they possibly could. Billy is super gaslighty and emotionally manipulative and scummy. And then you get to Derek, and he's like warm and supportive. And it's so ironic and sad that Sydney more seriously suspects Derek in the second movie than she ever did Billy in the first.
Well, and because she was so traumatized, which is also one of the many things that I love about all of the Scream films, is getting to see what happens to the final girl after she survives. It's something that we get to see so rarely. And I really like how they explored that with Sydney, where, you know, she has these different stages of development after surviving the first Woodsboro murders. And unfortunately for Derek, in Scream 2, she is in the paranoia stage.
And then he dies right in front of her in such a terrible way. you can just see the, like, the confusion and the exhaustion and the, oh God, I hate everything right now, just setting on her face so quick.
Oh, it's so true. God. And, you know, I'm not a fan of Mickey as a killer. Mickey is actually my second least favorite killer in the Scream films, second only to Jill. But I really love that moment. Timothy Oliphant, much like Jamie Kennedy, you can really feel that Timothy Oliphant gave it his all. And he had a lot of fun being Mickey. And so that earns points in his favor for me. But in that moment when he's like, boyfriend killer, it's like one of my favorite Mickey moments.
He's having so much fun with it because he's put in a lot of work and it's paying off and he's getting to enjoy it now.
As much as I don't care for Mickey as a killer, like comparatively, I do really love Debbie. And I am Debbie Salt, man. Oh my God. She's fantastic. I fucking love Debbie Salt. And I loved Laurie Metcalf's performance of Debbie. And I'm glad that it turned out to be Mickey and Debbie because of the initial version of the script being leaked so early on. There were so many changes to this movie and several different versions of the film with several different killers. So Kevin Williamson says that the initial script that was leaked was in fact a dummy script. But in the initial script, Derek and Hallie were the killers.
They would not have made believable killers.
No, I don't think so.
Also, in that Top Gun scene that you hate so much, he gives her his Greek letters and he says that they'll protect her. And that becomes true in a very real way because she, like, pistol whips Mickey in the face with them.
Yeah, she does. She delivers such a great line in that moment as well, because that's when she says, "You're forgetting one thing about Billy. I fucking killed him."
And then she just smacks across the face and it's just so satisfying.
Oh, it really is. It's such a great moment. I do really like that she steps right into that role of being a hero again in the finale of the film.
I really liked that scene where she gets on stage and they're doing their like dress rehearsal for that show. And, you know, she's Cassandra and she's doing her lines, and the production value on that was so good. Like their costumes and their masks and that set and everything was so good. Like my inner theater kid from high school was like, God, I wish we had that when I was doing theater.
If only they could have taken that level of, let's say, artfulness. I realize I've used that word twice tonight, but that artistic level from that scene and applied it to the opening scene of the movie.
It would have been so good.
It would have been much better.
And another thing about the rehearsal scene is when it cuts to the next scene, it gets me every time because I get so focused on that one. I forget every time that Randy dies in the next scene. So when it pulls up, I'm like, oh no, we're at this part already? Like every single time.
Well, and I mean, you talk about how distracted you were. At the same time, the characters in the scene where Randy dies are so distracted by their pursuit of the killer, trying to figure out who it is, that they don't even notice the killer's right there. You know,
yeah, just parked right on the street. He's in their news van. He's in their van.
Or she, rather, because it was
Debbie. Yeah, because it is Debbie.
Randy started talking shit about Billy and it pissed her off.
That, I think, is the one time that we see Debbie Salt be impulsive.
And it's so funny because Randy was such a stickler for the rules. He was the one who taught us the rules to surviving a horror film. So the fact that it happened in broad daylight was in and of itself kind of breaking what we had come to understand as a rule of horror. So exactly. I thought that was really interesting.
This death really gets me because Randy's my favorite and it's very jarring.
Oh,
you
yeah.
don't expect Ghostface to just yank him into a van in broad daylight. They've taken this fourth wall breaker, this Yoda, this Cassandra, and they just completely slaughter him out of nowhere.
It pissed everybody off. I mean, it upset a lot of fans. It upset Jamie Kennedy. I mean, he wasn't like outraged or anything. He's gone on in interviews to say that he realizes, you know, somebody had to die. And he didn't quite have the star power of the core three at the time. But even he was like, oh, man, fans have never recovered from Randy's death, which I think is why we love Kirby so much from Scream 4, because Kirby very much is like Kevin Williamson trying to give us Randy back without betraying his own story.
The fact that in both subsequent films, they toyed with the idea of trying to bring Randy back, albeit in very weird, like, convoluted ways, tells you just how much even the writers also just loved Randy.
Yeah, Kevin Williamson said, like, that he really did. He seriously considered, you know, writing it that Randy didn't actually die in the van, that he was very near death. And there was talk of bringing him back for Scream 4. But I mean, I get why Williamson decided against that. I back his plays. And if he thinks that it would have just been too big of a betrayal to his original story to bring Randy back, then I support that. But it's hard to let Randy go.
Oh, I definitely agree with you 100%. If I'm being honest, I would not change a thing about how Randy dies. as much as I would have loved to have seen him in the other two movies, well, alive, since we do see him posthumously in Scream 3.
I do really appreciate some of the meta moments in this movie in particular. For example, when Debbie asks Randy what his favorite scary movie is, and he says Showgirls, which is funny when you consider that Elizabeth Berkley auditioned for the role of Sydney in the first Scream, and a lot of the controversy and backlash that she received from being in Showgirls was a big part of why she was turned down for the role. And then Cece talking about Party of Five on the phone, which Neve Campbell was in at the time. Randy commenting on the fake nudes of Gail surfacing when the exact same thing had happened to Courtney Cox in real life. There were just a lot of really great meta moments that, as you mentioned earlier, really just don't exist in Scream 3 in the next film. And so I have to give Scream 2 props for what, for me, are some of the best meta moments in the series.
My next note, it just reads, ugh, cotton weary, because you don't the like next cotton. Part is not in Scream 2, because the next scene after Randy dies, it's Sydney in the library. And then Cotton fucking appears out of nowhere. And he is just, like, I feel for him. I do. But he's so creepy in this movie.
Sometimes the sleaziest characters turn out to be, like, among my favorites. Not all the time, because a lot of the time they're just sleazebags. But in the case of Cotton Weary, he reminds me, I love him in the same way that I love Judy from Sleepaway Camp. You want to smack him for being such a scumbag. But, like, it entertains me. It satisfies me on this, like, deep level. There was another alternate version of the ending where Cotton doesn't help Sydney, and in fact the two of them fight to the death and Cotton dies. And I'm really, really glad they didn't kill him. I'm glad that he, you know, kind of turned out to be a still scuzzy but halfway decent guy at the end, because I absolutely love the opening scene in Scream 3. As hokey and ridiculous as it is, which we're going to get to it. I was a big fan of the whole like 100% Cotton idea and dying the way that he did. And so I'm glad he lived, because he's Cotton. He's sleazy, but I love him.
Yeah. I don't think that even for a moment he was ever genuinely tempted to kill Sydney. Obviously, he was a little stressed because, you know, he just saw Dewey dead and Gail was convinced he was the killer. But I think he saw an opportunity to make Sydney sweat a little. And I do really want to gush a little bit about Debbie Salt. I can definitely see where Billy Loomis got it. His penchant for murder and mayhem, he definitely inherited from his mother.
My two favorite killers in the Scream series are Billy Loomis and his mother. I think that they were on a par with one another in terms of shock value, in terms of motive, and just pure, unadulterated rage.
Especially when Gail has fallen into the pit. When it's just Sydney and Debbie on stage, she has some serious crazy eyes going on.
Yeah, God, she's great. And Laurie Metcalf just fucking owns it.
She had one of the best, most surprising reveals.
Do you think Mickey knew that Debbie was bringing Gail with her through the door? Like, how do you think Mickey felt when the first thing he saw was Gail?
You know, I would like to think that he knew it was going to happen, but realistically, like, he's gone straight from the car crash to the auditorium. And
yes, if he wouldn't know.
No, I think it would have been funny for him to be like, well, that's not who I was referencing, but that works too. Sure, let's just roll with it. Gail and Dewey keep popping back up like weeds. It's great.
Yeah, I love the line that Cotton delivers when they pull Gail up out of the orchestra pit. And he's like, geez, Gail, you got more lives than a cat.
She does.
Well, especially because she was supposed to die in Scream 2.
You know, I'm so happy that she didn't.
Oh, same. I can't imagine the third and fourth Scream films without her.
Watching through them for the first time, I was like, God, I fucking hate Gail Weathers so much.
Really?
She annoyed the yes, she annoyed the shit out of me. I was like, can you stop? But now I'm just like, no, you be ruthless and you do whatever it takes to get your story. I love her so much. I also love that she respects herself enough and is passionate enough about her work that she's not going to let love of a man stop her from going after her dreams, even if that man is Dewey.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's a big part, actually, of why Gail's story is one of my favorites from the final film. And we'll get to that. But like, I love Gail in Scream 4. And that is such a huge aspect of her personality that they maintained very well. And they developed the older version of Gail from that personality so beautifully. All right, so we've been at this for a while, so we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will look at Screams 3 and 4. I think we're probably going to talk about 4 first, because it is number 3 on both of our lists, and then we'll save Scream 3 for last. for various reasons. And we're back. Welcome back, Eli.
It's good to be back now that we're not all tired and middle of the night about it.
Yeah, we may have taken an entire day's break so that we could get some rest because we were at this for hours last night. So we decided yesterday, even though Scream 3 is atrociously number 2 on my ranked list, as it is 4th on yours and definitely the most complicated entry in the series, we decided to just go ahead and talk first about Scream 4, which is number 3 on both of our lists.
I don't really care for the opening on Scream 4.
What? Either. That's my favorite part.
I did not enjoy the fake outs. I don't know. I kind of liked the first two girls better than the two girls that are actually part of like the Scream universe. Who was it? It was Lucy Hale and someone else. Because you have the first two that die, and then Anna Paquin and Kristen Bell, and then it goes into the actual movie.
Yeah, see, Anna Paquin and Kristen Bell were my favorite thing about Scream 4. You have the two types of horror fans. You know, you have the horror fans that are much more capable of suspending their disbelief and just kicking back and enjoying it for the ride. And then you have the flip side of that fandom, where you have the taking it way too seriously, hyper-analyzation, critical fans. I definitely fall more into that second category, and it can be extremely annoying. Obviously, the film needed to maintain that self-referential attitude. And in my opinion, it still does it throughout the film, but it doesn't do it quite as much as the first three Scream films did. And I think that's one of the reasons why I enjoyed the opening scenes, because it was really one of the best moments for that in a film that really kind of lacked it in a lot of other areas.
They do focus much less on the rules of horror and the genre. Honestly, it feels more like a Kill by Numbers kind of thing, where it's kind of got the spirit of Scream, but not really. Because the killers, I think, don't actually care that much about it. They care about getting the attention at the end of it. They don't care about how they get there as much.
Yeah. Even when they talk about the rules in Scream 4, even when they do kind of reference the construct of a horror film, they do it in a way that really kind of irritates me. Like when Robbie is about to die and he stops Ghostface by saying, you know, "You can't kill me, I'm gay." Earlier when they're at Cinema Club and they're having a conversation about the new rules of horror films, the one that they seem to harp on the most is that in order to survive in a horror movie, you pretty much have to be gay. I can honestly not think of a single horror movie where being gay saved your life.
I know that it definitely did not save the father at the beginning of Sleepaway Camp.
For sure.
I think it was because it was 2011 and they were trying to be all woke and with the times.
I was super disappointed by the lack of reference, humor, and commentary in the film. There was a lot about, you know, fame seeking, for sure. And I did really enjoy everything with the webcams at the stab party, the stabathon. And I liked the idea that they were like live streaming the kills. I thought that was really cool.
Oh yeah, I definitely enjoyed the use of technology in the film. And that's kind of true for all of the Scream films. I know you hate that voice changer in Scream 3, but...
Oh, I hate it so much.
I respect what they were trying to do with it. They were trying to be techie about it and have fun with it.
Yeah. So, okay. So you weren't crazy about the introductory scenes, which is fair, although it breaks my heart a little. What was your favorite thing about Scream 4?
The one that pops into my head first and that comes to mind is when Kirby and Jill are in Jill's bedroom and they're talking to Olivia on the phone.
Oh, yeah.
And then Ghostface calls and he says he's in the closet, and then he just bursts out into Olivia's room and just absolutely massacres her. And they see it in the window and they're like screaming and yelling and begging for help. And I thought that was really interesting. The fact that they incorporated that, like the houses across, I thought that was a really cool touch.
Yeah, I agree. Can we just take a second to appreciate Hayden fucking Panettiere? Because she was amazing.
She was so good. I wanted her to be the final girl so bad.
She alone is one of the reasons why I could never put this film last. Obviously, there were things that I didn't like about it. And I, like you, I really do not care for Jill as a killer. I was really just underwhelmed by the whole Jill thing. In that regard, I would put the killers from Scream 2 above Jill for sure. But I can't put this movie last because of how much I love Kirby.
She carries this movie.
I was a little disappointed that they didn't let her live, her being a representation of Randy, and Williamson knowing just how much everyone misses Randy and wanted him to come back. I felt that letting Kirby live would have kind of been a small consolation, you know, like a way of letting Randy live through
Kirby. Yeah, if Kirby had lived, I think that would have been a pretty cool way to leave the door open for more if they wanted to.
There is some talk about that, about Kirby returning for Scream 5, because we don't actually see her body dead. We see her get stabbed a couple of times, and then she falls to the ground, and she is bleeding to death, but then we leave her there, and they never show her again. So it is very possible that she survived in the same way that Dewey survives in 2, or the first one, or all of them, the way Dewey always survived.
1 and 2 and 3 and... and 4, I think he gets the shit kicked out of him in this one too. Oh yes, with the bedpan.
Oh yeah, bedpan, I forgot. To the face.
Poor Dewey. He never really has a good time with these movies.
Although he did get to marry Gail Weathers, so.
He did. He married Gail Weathers.
And I love Gail in this movie. I think she is perfect from start to finish.
I think it would have been a funny little detail if they had Dewey take her name.
I would have loved that.
That would have been really cute.
Yeah, that would have been great. There are so many things I love about this film. It's a special movie because it was Wes Craven's last. Obviously, I was so stoked when they announced that Williamson was returning, because as much as I will defend Scream 3 to the death, I would never try to argue that Aaron, who wrote the script for Scream 3, could even remotely compare. So I was very glad that Williamson came back. I think that it accounts for a lot of the really smart dialogue in the film. I just, fucking Jill, she kills it for me.
She does. Honestly, I hadn't seen it in years and I had only seen it once, so I rewatched it. And the second time around, I will admit that I do actually really enjoy this movie, but I cannot get into any scene with Jill in it. She's this like discordant piece that just does not fit. Feels like they were putting together a Scream jigsaw puzzle, and it's like one of those like small 1,000-piece puzzles, and then they go and get one of those giant honking pieces from a puzzle that's like 4 pieces to put together, and then they just like shoved it in the middle and tried to convince me that it was supposed to go there.
Yeah, she's not. I don't like it.
And I can't help but think maybe I would have bought her character a little bit more if it had been literally any other actress. You could have put Betty friggin' White in to play like a 16-year-old girl, and I would have found that more believable.
I would love to see Scream 4 reshot with Betty White in the Jill role.
Exactly. That's entertaining.
I talked about this at length when I talked about like female villains in horror movies, about how difficult it is to do female-driven crazy in horror films and why. A lot of the time I think it's about the writing, but I think in this case, it was both. It was Emma Roberts not really being able to sell me on the crazy. And the writing. I really wasn't all that crazy about the Sydney thing. I just think
they're just rehashing Roman's motive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a couple of thoughts on that. I think personally, part of the problem with believable female killers in movies is that they don't take into account that because of the way women are socialized and raised, the motives for a male killer aren't necessarily going to be believable coming from a woman. Because right. There are different influences there.
As a woman who loves horror movies and who wants to see more female-driven crazy in films, you could very easily take any other gendered character and plop it into the role of Jill, and it would probably be just as believable. And I don't even think that it's just to do with the gender. I think it's the word you used with socialization. And I think that that's such an important word in this case. What happened to Jill in her life that would have put her on this road? It doesn't feel as fluid as it did with Billy and Stu. There were telltale signs in the first Scream. We got none of those signs with Jill.
Yeah, in the first 3 movies, we have killers who have they have catalysts for why they're doing what they're doing. You know, in the first one, you have Stu who kind of goes along with Billy, and then Debbie particularly finds Mickey on purpose. So the other 2 killers, they may not have as strong of a motivation as their leaders, for lack of a better idea, but I still buy it.
I agree. And I think too, you know, when you consider the character of Mickey, for example, which you could definitely say that in a way, Jill is sort of like Mickey 2.0, because her motivations are very similar to Mickey's, with a little bit of the Roman thrown in as well. Mickey didn't carry the film. You need someone with a deeper, more significant motivation to carry as the killer, I think. And that's why Mickey and Debbie work. Because you have Debbie, who has something that would really drive a person, which is vengeance. With Jill and Charlie, they really have kind of similar motivations that are equally empty.
Neither of them feels like the mastermind is the problem. they both feel like they're almost the grunts or the secondary killers who have been manipulated into it by a stronger personality and a stronger leader. I think another thing that Scream 4 lacks that I really enjoyed with the other three movies is the red herring. You don't really get any of that in Scream 4.
Oh, they were pushing Trevor pretty hard, but yeah, it wasn't effective.
All of the red herring things with Trevor were for the audience only. They zoomed in on him looking creepy and menacing a couple of times, but nobody ever really seems suspicious of him.
I didn't even think about that, but that's true. The whole killer thing in Scream 4, I think, is its biggest shortcoming. If we hadn't had to focus so much of our attention and energy on Sid, Dewey, and Gale, which I'm glad that we did because those are the characters I love, but like if you had taken them and kind of put them way, way in the back or just remove them all together, the kid's story probably could have been much better. It could have been much more fleshed out. We could have cared a lot more. There was a good foundation there.
That's exactly how I feel about it. I think they were trying to do too much in one movie and they spread themselves too thin. And as a result, a lot of things fell flat because they just didn't have the time.
Have you seen the deleted scene of the newer generation of kids sitting around the fountain talking that sort of mirrors the scene from the first film?
I have not, but that sounds like it would be fun to watch.
The dialogue doesn't work quite as well as it did in the first film, but I love that scene. I think apart from the party at Kirby's, I think them sitting at the fountain is really the only other time that we see all of these kids together. And they have this conversation about who the killer is. Just that one scene could have gone a long way to tightening up some of those threads.
Yeah, because we don't really have the kids talking about who they think the killer could be either. None of them really have anyone that they're suspicious of. None of them seem to be taking this super seriously.
I think the only time we really even hear them have a serious discussion about the situation that they're in is when they're at the police station. The three girls are talking with Dewey. And when Kirby's like, am I going to be next? You know, that whole thing. That's like one of my favorite little moments for that younger generation. And it's because they're actually acknowledging what's happening, which might have been part of the commentary. You know, that might have been partly an observation of the newer generation where we are kind of so tuned out and there's a bit of a divorce from reality because of how much we live on our phones and on the internet. But I think if they were trying to comment on that, they could have probably been a bit clearer.
I love Gale and Dewey, but I'm so over them starting out the movies estranged from one another and having problems and then being reunited by all the killings, especially with Deputy Judy. I would have loved to have seen something where she was more like an actual protege working with Dewey and like getting along with Gale, working together, because you saw that in the third movie with Jennifer, where she's working with Dewey and she's supposed to be Gale and Gale is jealous. And then she ends up working with them, and I really liked that. And then you get to 4, and you've got Deputy Judy, who is obviously trying to undermine Gale. And I'm just tired of seeing female characters in conflict because of a man.
Yeah, it gets old. I really liked that Gale herself was in conflict. That is one of the things that I think makes Gale such an interesting character in Scream 4, is that it does make sense to me that after 10 years in Woodsboro, that she would be crawling out of her skin, especially now that Sydney has published a book, which really just reminds her of what a failure she is in her own eyes. So that part I really enjoyed, but I definitely could have done without, yeah, just the whole fighting over Dewey thing. Like you said, we got that with Jennifer in Scream 3, and I felt that it was very entertaining. We didn't need to do it again.
Yeah.
Speaking of Gale in this movie, I loved the character of Rebecca, who was Sydney's assistant, but the scene between Rebecca and Gale. Gale like gets in her face and she's so proud of herself because she chases Rebecca away.
I did really like the character of Rebecca, actually. I thought she was very entertaining.
That's Alison Brie, though. She just nails everything she does.
Her death in this was another pretty good scene. Them just yeeting her body off of the level where they're at in the garage, just straight out into Dewey's press conference, right when he's saying they've got things under control.
I love that.
Oh, it's such a good moment. I felt so bad for Dewey because he's never actually been in a real position of power during these killings before. And he's trying so hard to put on a brave face and keep people calm. And then she just goes crashing into that news van.
Yeah, I thought there was a lot of that. There were a lot of really nice, funny moments. A lot of the things with Haas and Perkins, when Haas and Perkins are talking about cops in horror movies. which they tried to do in Scream 3 with Patrick Dempsey's character and his partner, but it didn't come across that well. And they really did a great job, I felt, in Scream 4.
Gale sneaking into the watch party and the drinking game that they have with the Stabathon movies was sounded really fun to me.
Yeah, I really enjoyed everything surrounding and during the Stabathon, I thought was great. And I love when Gail's in the car before she goes in and she's trying to convince Dewey, you know, about what's happening. And she says, how meta can you get? And he's like, how what? She's like, I don't know. I heard them say it.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
All in all, it could have been a lot worse. I was worried when they first announced that Scream 4 was happening. I didn't want it. I was just perfectly happy with the three Screams we had already had. And so I was pleasantly surprised by the film. I went in with very low expectations. And I do think we could have gotten a much worse fourth Scream film, for sure.
Once you start poking at it and like pulling on threads, everything just sort of unravels very quickly.
That's so well said, I think. So very true. All right, you know, I think the time has come for us to talk about your least favorite Scream movie and one of my favorites. I think it's finally time for us to talk about Scream 3.
Scream 3. I am viewing it in a new light now that you have mentioned that this took place just after Columbine. I never really connected it to something that would have taken place within a historical context.
Yeah, that's one of the many things I love about the horror genre is how reflective it often is of the society from which it emerges, you know, in the time. And I remember I was a goth teenage girl in a small town when Columbine happened. And my friends and I, we felt a lot of the backlash from that event. And it was difficult for us. It was difficult for our parents. We would have absolutely have gotten a much different film if Columbine had not happened. Scream 3 would have been scary. I wish that we had gotten the original like fan cult storyline that Williamson envisioned for 3. But because of just the world freaking out in the wake of Columbine about violence in the media, I couldn't have seen a Scream film happening any other way. The MPAA would never have allowed it. The studio would never have allowed it. So it's easy for me to forgive this movie because of the circumstances surrounding it.
Yeah, definitely thinking about it more in context helps me to not be as annoyed with it. As a horror comedy, it definitely works. The characters just don't feel fleshed out and real enough to me, especially the Hollywood actors.
Oh, I think that's totally fair.
I did like the opening a little bit more.
I love Cotton's death. I love everything leading up to Cotton's death.
His original sin within the franchise is having an affair with Maureen Prescott. Think about everything that came as a consequence to that. He's arrested for murder. He's sentenced to death. He gets acquitted. He spends the whole second movie trying to get a hold of fame and attention. And then the third movie, finally he's established and he seems to be decently happy with his life. He just gets brutally murdered out of nowhere.
Yep. And I also love that they established that he hasn't learned anything because he gets roped in by flirting with another woman over the phone.
Oh, he does. He's 100%. He's a total hound dog.
He's 100% Cotton, 100% Sleaze. Cotton and Sarah Darling, the two people who try to call for help in this movie, I think get the best deaths.
I enjoyed Sarah Darling's because she's trying to find something to fight back with. Yeah. And they're all just fake knives and rubber and retractable blades. And she's like, you guys suck.
I love it so much.
She tries to fight back.
It really makes me wonder if there had been any real weapons in that room, would Sarah Darling have lived? She fought hard.
Like, she did. She was going to take Ghostface out.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me that Ghostface is in that room with her the way that he is, that he's like standing there on that rack of Ghostface costumes, like right when she comes in and hides behind them. It's so far-fetched, but I love the way it looks. And yeah, mm-hmm. I love the prop fight that follows.
It does make sense in the rules of the trilogy, according to Randy, where everything is a little bit more exaggerated and a little less realistic.
Yeah.
One of my things was, so after Cotton dies, you cut to Sydney, and she missed so many security systems. That's a nice, subtle way of pointing out that Sydney has some serious PTSD. Sydney may be alive and healthy, but that doesn't necessarily mean she's doing the best.
That is one of the things that I love most about this Scream in particular, is where Sydney is in her life. I love getting to see what happens to the final girls. And I really felt like they made very good, very smart choices with Sydney. I love that she lives in isolation, that she has a dog. She probably could have picked a bit of a fiercer breed of dog, but like, I love that she has a guard dog, the security system. I also love that she has become like a crisis counselor, a women's crisis counselor.
I do love that, yes.
It's all so good.
I really like how in-depth we get with her mommy issues. I'm with you. I hate the whole, oh, we got a hold of Maureen's voice somehow. But I do like that Sydney is being haunted by the ghost of her mother. I think it's really interesting that Sydney is still grappling with these conflicting notions of her mother all these years later.
Yeah. I'm just not as much a fan of Aaron Kruger as a writer as I am Kevin Williamson. So I feel like a lot of the dialogue is sort of lacking that Williamson punch. But Kruger did a wonderful job of ending Sydney's journey to understand her mother.
Especially because in this film, we get that missing piece and it helps Sydney understand her mother finally. And so I thought that was a really cool closing chapter.
I agree. And I also love that we got a little bit of closure regarding Randy.
Oh, I love Randy's resurrection video in this movie. It was so exciting. The sets of the first movie, like where they recreated Woodsboro, I really liked that touch.
I did too.
When Sydney is running away from Ghostface on the set and she stumbles into the room that is set up to be the scene of her mother's murder, so much of these films is because of Maureen Prescott, and yet she dies off camera a year before the first movie starts. Getting to see Sydney in that room, it's just a really cool moment.
I completely agree. I really don't like when like Maureen's body all covered in that bloody tarp starts talking to her, because again, I think it's just extremely unrealistic. But everything else about that was so smartly done and just so fun.
I thought that Roman's birthday was a cool way of subtly establishing why this is all happening now.
Yeah, I do like Roman. There are things that I don't like about Roman, but for the most part, I buy Roman much more so than I buy Jill, at least. And yeah. I like the third act of the film a lot, and the reveal of Roman and the conversations between him and Sydney, this like sibling rivalry thing that they have going on where they just devolve and they are not even having a conversation anymore. They're just screaming, fuck you, at each other. I really like that dynamic.
I don't feel the episode would be complete if we didn't mention Jennifer's death, because she was just so good.
Trying to convince Ghostface that she is the killer in Stab 3.
Yeah, she's like, no, I'm the killer in Stab 3. You don't want to kill me. I'm supposed to live. And it's just, it is such a good scene. And I really like, after all of that, that end scene where they're at back at Sydney's house. Sydney opening up those gates at the end is such a great visual.
That's a big part of why I didn't want there to be another Scream film, because I really love the way that Scream 3 ends. The victorious music, the opening of the gates, the fact that she leaves her door open.
Yeah, I was satisfied.
I wanted to kind of make a quick note about something that also really impressed me about this movie. Obviously, Scream 3 is all over the place. The movie itself, but also the production of this movie was all over the place. They just kept filming alternate versions of scenes like throughout the entire film so that you had this huge collage of stories. Patrick Lussier, I felt, did such a fantastic job of taking all of that and editing it together into a comprehensive linear story that didn't feel confusing. And the reason I'm pointing that out is because I have had such an issue with Patrick Lussier since the release of the My Bloody Valentine 3D, the remake that he did. And I didn't realize until I was researching for this episode that Patrick Lussier was the editor for the first three Scream films, that he edited this fucking clusterfuck of a movie. Hats off to Patrick Lussier. I'm sorry that I have been so hard on him. I almost completely forgive him for the atrocity that was the My Bloody Valentine remake, just because of what a great job he did editing this film.
There wasn't any indication watching the film that there was any kind of chaos behind the scenes.
Right, right.
It's a very linear, easy to follow, very well put together film, regardless of what actually happens in it. So yeah. He did a really good job.
I do think that we should talk about Kevin Williamson's original intention for this film. I personally would love to have seen that. And there are rumors that they're going to be kind of trying to go that route with Scream 5. Originally, the idea was that Scream 3 would see a cult following. It would be revealed that Stu Mocker didn't actually die and that he was in fact in prison and that he had a kind of cult following of fans that for the third film would be the ones terrorizing Sydney. When I first heard about that, I thought, okay, that's fucking brilliant. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know how much I enjoy it with Stu, just because he wasn't the mastermind behind the original Woodsboro killings. I think I would have enjoyed it a little bit more as an idea and a concept if it had been like Billy or Mrs. Loomis. I don't know, because I did really, really enjoy Stu. And maybe if they went back and established him a little bit more as an independent killer in his own right. I think that there are things that they could do with it to make it really fun. So I would be interested in seeing something like that.
So are you excited about Scream 5? Are you looking forward to it?
I am ambivalently cautious is the best way I can put it. I've been excited about such things in the past and been horribly disappointed, but I've also been pleasantly surprised. So I think I'm just gonna wait and try not to form any prior expectations.
I think that's a good attitude to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that really kind of concerns me the most about it is that Wes won't be there for it, that it'll be the first time we've had a Scream film without Wes at the helm. And I know Neve Campbell had initially said, no, I don't want to be a part of a Scream film that Wes isn't a part of. But I guess she received a letter from the guys that are doing Scream 5 that just completely turned her around, that convinced her that these guys really do want to capture and honor the spirit of the previous films. And they wanted to make Wes proud, you know, and honor his memory. So I guess if they were able to turn Sid, I call her Sydney.
Yeah, I will reserve judgment until I've seen it for the first time, basically.
Yeah, or at least until we have more details. There's so much speculation right now. I have to say, I didn't plan this. I'm really glad it happened this way, though, because it kind of creates an additional purpose to this exercise. I think I would actually like to revise my ranking.
Yes.
Yeah. Our conversation has turned me around a little. So I'm still going to put 3 at number 2 for the reasons that I've said, but I'm switching Scream 2 and Scream 4 around. I'm going to say my new ranking is the first Scream, Scream 3, Scream 2, and then Scream 4. You really turned. Yeah.
Vindication. I have won an argument. I have successfully argued for the enjoyability of Scream 2. I am very satisfied right now.
You did. You really turned me around on some of it. And I hadn't, there were a lot of things about the film I actually hadn't thought about in a while because it's the one that I watch the least often. I wasn't being fair to it. So thank you for changing my ranks, my ranked list a little bit. So I'm very excited because not only have I just been really happy to have you here with me, Eli, but also it's been a while since I've covered like a teen slasher. For the first time in a long time, we get to do some senior class superlatives. Our first category is most memorable death. And I think we decided to give that to Casey Becker.
Casey Becker from the first Scream, the opening kill of the series. That was so impactful and so suspenseful and just pulled you right in and it ripped your heart right out.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It was so shocking. I mean, I still think about it a lot. It's one of the most memorable deaths I've ever seen. Next category is most underrated side character. And I think that you and I both are in agreement that this should go to Kenny the cameraman.
Absolutely. Scream 1 again.
Now, a lot of these superlatives are going to OG Scream characters. But yeah, I just always felt that Kenny was a bit of an unsung hero. And I think he was a good guy. And I miss him. This next category I think is probably my favorite. And that is most believable motive.
I think that I'm going to have to go ahead and give it to Billy Loomis from Scream 1. He was very fleshed out as a character and a killer. Everybody he killed was killed with a purpose. He had a reason for everything that he did, even if he was absolutely crazy, and has that wonderful scene in Stu's house where Sydney has got away and he goes ape shit and just tears that living room apart.
I love that. He's like tearing apart couch cushions as if she could ever possibly be in them. As an extension of most believable motive, we have most likely to succeed at killing Sydney. Ugh, we have to give it to Jill.
Yeah, I'm not crazy about it, but I will give credit where credit is due. Jill Roberts comes the closest of any of the ghost faces to actually killing Sydney Prescott.
It's true. She got pretty fucking close. She hurt her pretty badly. And so as much as I hate us for having to say it, Jill was the most likely to succeed. All right, we have a classic category here. It can never be overlooked, and that is for best dressed. Now, we are doing best dressed of the franchise, so I think we're going to give it to Gail Weathers.
Oh, 100%. Gail rocks it in every single movie that she's in, even with those I see highlights.
Or the fucking bangs.
Oh, God.
From Scream 3.
I am going to go ahead and do an honorable mention for best dressed Tatum Riley, Scream 1.
Yeah.
That wardrobe was so 1990s.
Agreed. And last but not least, there are so many characters in the Scream series. And so many of the characters helped Sydney along the way. They worked so hard. So many of these characters found heroes, you know, within themselves. So we want to give out an MVP award for the entire series, for all four films. And it is a tie. So the award for MVP goes to Randy Meeks and Kirby Reed.
Randy was so essential in the first three movies, and he dies so hard, and it was such a hard death to witness and experience, and I'm really glad that we picked Randy, because he was just, he's my favorite, and Kirby is such a wonderful, almost spiritual reincarnation of Randy in the fourth one.
Absolutely. Definitely one of my favorite scenes in the fourth Scream that I don't think we got to, when Kirby is tasked with answering a question about remakes, and she just starts firing off every remake, you know, that has come out in the last X amount of years. It was such a great moment for Kirby. I mean, granted, Kirby didn't really contribute quite as much to like solving the mystery, but their knowledge and love of horror films reflects us as audience members, and they help solidify our understanding of the Scream films as love letters to the genre. Thank you so much for hanging out with me and talking to me about the Scream movies, Eli. I'm so fucking glad we finally got to do this.
So am I. It has been an absolute blast, and it was well worth the year that we waited to do it. I love these movies, and I love your podcast, and it's been really cool to get to talk about and geek out about these movies that I love so much, and actually get to go really in depth with you and discuss them and actually have something to show for it at the end.
I agree completely. And thank you for being a friend.
Absolutely.
So that was the abridged version of mine and Eli's two-day-long examination of Screams 1 through 4. I hope you enjoyed it, and I would love to hear your thoughts on the Scream films. How would you rank them? Which characters do you love? Which do you hate? Are you looking forward to Scream 5? Come to the Discord and share your opinions with me. If you aren't a member of the Discord yet and you would like to be, you'll find an open invitation to our server in the description of this podcast on Anchor, or you can find me on social media. I'm Final Girl Friday pretty much everywhere, or email me at finalgirlconfessions@gmail.com. I want to thank Eli one more time for joining me and for being so patient with me. I know it took me a lifetime to get this episode edited. Thank you for waiting and just being generally awesome. And thanks to my other patrons as well, Susie Q, Mel, Alan, and Xerxes, for continuing to champion this little passion project during such uncertain times. Also for funding events like the Sleepaway Camp giveaway, which I'm finally going to talk about. Next week, I'll be taking a long look at Sleepaway Camp from 1983. I chose this as the B-movie of the month for May, my birthday month, because it was released the year I was born, and also because I absolutely love it. And I'll be wrapping up that episode by giving away a small swag bag. Inside this bag will be a collector's edition Shout Factory Blu-ray of Sleepaway Camp, a Tales from the Waterfront comic book-style Sleepaway Camp poster, and a Death by Curling Iron enamel pin from Terror Threads. You don't have to be a member of Patreon or the Discord community to enter this giveaway. All you have to do is write me a letter from Camp Arawak. The Dear Mom and Dad Summer Camp letter is one of my favorite seasonal and currently endangered tropes across all genres, and I love it when you guys write me stuff. So imagine what life might be like for a camper, counselor, or killer at Camp Arawak. Write it down and send it my way. You can email the letter to me, send it in a message via Slasher or Instagram, or post it in the B-Movie of the Month channel on Discord. I'll have my good friend, Jason McAnally, writer of the fantasy horror epic Gray Spaces, be the judge of which letter is best, and whoever he picks will win the swag. My plan for May was to post a lot more Sleepaway Camp content across social media as part of my month-long celebration of the film, but I suck at social media, so I failed miserably there. Next month, things will be different. Still learning. God damn it. That's all I've got for today, guys. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to screen your calls, and until next time, creep it real.